I might say that everything old is new again. If you're a Counterpoint regular, you'll remember Simon Long. He was our Asia correspondent and was based in Singapore. He's now gone back to London. If you're new to Counterpoint, well, you missed out. But in any event, we've got him back. He's in London and he can talk to us about a broad range of subjects, not just Asia, and he joins us now. Simon Long, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Good to be back, Amanda, but not so much of the old.
No, just old times, not old in age. Hell, I'm 64. I've got no business saying that to anybody. Don't worry about that. Now, look, you and I've mentioned in passing over time China and the size of the economy and whether anybody imagines that it could go pear-shaped. Is it too big to fail? Is it impossible for it to fail? Is it likely? What can you tell people like me who, you know, I read the paper, but I'm not an economist? What should I know? What should I keep in the back of my mind about China?
Well, that nothing's really too big to fail, and that there are big concerns about the Chinese economy. I think it's unlikely to go completely pear-shaped in the near future. And some of the concerns that were rattling world markets maybe a year ago have in fact eased. The economy's slowed down, but it's still growing at 6.5% a year is the forecast for this year, and they normally meet their forecasts, which is, after all, pretty strong. The two big concerns looming are, firstly, that to keep it growing, enormous amounts of debt have been sloshing around the economy, and that someday there's going to have to be a reckoning, because a lot of that debt is non-functional. It's never going to be repaid. And a lot of it is actually outside the formal banking system, which raises other concerns. So that's a worry. But in the short term, I think it's unlikely to create a crisis for political reasons. This year sees the five-yearly Communist Party Congress later in the year in October, and the government is unlikely to allow any sort of economic stability to rattle things in the run-up to that. It's their big political moment, and it still has enormous resources, huge foreign exchange reserves to keep things stable if it can, for at least in the short term. So I don't think you need lose any sleep about the Chinese economy crashing between now and the end of the year. The big caveat, of course, though, is what happens in relations with America and what happens if Donald Trump fulfills some of his campaign threats to impose punitive tariffs on Chinese imports, to make things a lot harder for Chinese exporters in his country, and what effect that might have on not just China, but the whole world economy.
And what would be the consequence? I mean, from just a layperson's point of view, I've always looked at trade this way when people have said, you know, why don't we buy Australian? I said, well, that's fine, so long as you don't want the Chinese to say only buy Chinese. If you want them to buy our stuff, you've got to be prepared to buy their stuff. And that's what I'd say to Trump. You know, start this off if you want, but the card you put down on the table, we're going to increase tariffs and make it harder for things to come in from China, is only going to be the first card on the table, and the Chinese will have a lot more cards to put down. So if I were he, I would be thinking very carefully about this.
Indeed. The argument of those who would support him being tough on China is that actually the US matters more to China than the other way around. China exports to the US about 4% of its GDP by value. American exports to China about 1% of its GDP, and there's a huge trade deficit. And part of that is because of unfair restrictions on foreign imports into China, and because the American economy is remarkably open. But you're quite right, if Donald Trump does impose 45% tariffs across the board, as at one time he was threatening to do, the sufferers would in the first instance be American consumers. American prices would shoot up. There are no obvious substitutes either in America or elsewhere in the world to produce many of the products that American consumers want to buy. So it would be an act of self-harm in that sense. It would also, of course, as you suggest, prompt almost immediate Chinese retaliation. So there would be a loss for the American exporters, for many of whom China is an extremely important market, particularly for car makers, for Boeing in particular, which is looking on China as its first $1 trillion market over the next few years. So it's a dangerous game. And then, of course, the risks to the rest of the world, not just those two countries, but the whole global trading system would appear to be in some danger, because it would be a breach of WTO rules, the World Trade Organization rules. It would in effect mean America moving outside the WTO and the rules-based international trading system would crumble.
iPhones. Well, Samsung phones, any phone. The phones that everyone has these days, a large amount of them are made in China, aren't they?
They are, but then a lot of the value in them comes from America, doesn't it? And I think that, isn't it more than 1 million people at Foxconn, the firm that puts iPhones together, employ in China? So, yeah, there's a lot of Chinese employment riding on the relationship with America. But there's also quite a lot of American employment riding on the other way around, on the relationship with China and on exports to China. So although I think few would dispute that there aren't ways in which the trading relationship could be made more fairer and more equal, and that American exporters and global exporters do suffer in China, it's a two-way street.
Mm. Simon, I was actually thinking about younger people than myself who are obsessed with having the new phone and new technology. And since so much of that does come out of China, would a trade war put the prices up for the United States?
Yes, and I think somebody, I can't remember which organization it is, but one has done some calculations on this and reckons that in two items that young people in particular like, if you take clothing and fashion, that might rise in America in price by up to 40%, 38%, I think was the figure, and for smartphones, by 20 to 30%. There's nowhere else these things could easily be made as cheaply as in China.
Mm. I'm talking with Simon Long from The Economist, largely about China, the United States, and I hope we get on to something about Europe and Brexit. Now, far be it for me to suggest that people, when you make a rule, try to get around it, but just say there is a trade war. Are there ways in which one might, if one wanted to import, for example, just say, you know, some iPhones to the United States, that you would set up a dummy company in another country and import them from China to that country and then to you, and then that dummy company could just switch the shipping arrangements and send it off straight to the United States? Does that kind of skullduggery happen?
It does on a small scale, and it happens with weapons, for example, doesn't it? That get around sanctions. That when there are sanctions, there are normally ways can be found around it.
Yeah.
But to do it on the volume and the scale of Chinese imports, Chinese exports into the US,
I think would be almost
unthinkable.
A bit hard to hide all that technology.
Yeah, I could take a few in your suitcase, perhaps.
Have you ever wondered how many ships a year go from China to the United States laden with technical stuff?
No, but I, as you know, I used to live in Singapore and used to watch boatloads of stuff with containers going past, mostly on their way from China to the West. So, yeah, the volume is simply staggering.
Mm. Brexit is obviously looming. What can you tell us about the next steps? It's okay to do your formal procedures, fine, but then there's a lot more to happen after that.
Well, there's now, with Article 50 of the treaty triggered, there's now a formal 2-year deadline to get everything sorted out. And I think it's beginning to dawn on a lot of people quite how much there is to be sorted out, quite how enmeshed in the UK's legal system, economy, way of life, the EU had become over the 50 years of membership. So we're in a very tricky position. The position of those supporting Brexit has changed rather remarkably, it seems to me, since the referendum. I wasn't in the UK during it, but follow the campaign closely and know that people were told that, look, you can leave the European Union, but you can we can remain part of the single market, remain in the customs union, and nothing really will change. Soon became apparent that wasn't possible, because one of the key points that Brexit supporters wanted was to take back control, particularly of Britain's borders and of immigration. And for the EU, the free movement of labour is an integral part of the single market. So come January, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, made her speech setting out what Brexit would be, and it was a Brexit in which UK would accept that it left the single market, it would accept that it left the single customs union. It would still insist on removing itself from the jurisdiction of the EU's court, the European Court of Justice. But it would all be all right because we would just negotiate a free trade agreement in which we would incorporate basically everything we had under the EU, and things would go on the same. Now, that may be possible.
Sounds nice, but there's a long way between saying that and getting it done.
Yes, and it seems to me sort of flawed as a prospect, in that, you know, if you can have all the benefits of EU membership without being a member, what's the EU for? So it's not really something that the EU could tolerate. So I think we're in for a very difficult negotiation on that. We're in for a very difficult negotiation first on what is the cost of the exit bill, on how much the UK will have to pay to leave this club, what its liabilities are in terms of its promises to existing EU institutions that it will have to fulfil, what are its promises to EU employees that are owed pensions, and so on. So it's going to be a very tricky negotiation. Very few people outside the British government, it seems to me, appear to think that it can be fully done within 2 years. So we're probably looking at having to come up with some form of a transitional arrangement to remove what has become known as the cliff edge of March 29th, 2019, when we just fall into the post-EU world with no agreements with anybody.
Mm. Simon, can I ask you about the terrorist event last week outside the Parliament? We saw obviously the whole thing was very unattractive, but we saw some very unattractive media coverage here. There was a Muslim woman walking past on her phone, and one of our media outlets published the photo at something of a distance, and because it was tweeted that way. And the suggestion was that this woman was walking past in a very uncaring fashion and didn't care what had happened. A closer look at the photograph showed that she actually appeared very concerned. There was no question about whether she might be phoning relatives to say she's okay, phoning relatives to say, I feel unsafe, I've got a headscarf on and there's been a terrorist attack and I might myself get attacked. No idea whether she'd spoken to people before about helping. And no suggestion about, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, my mother said, there's an accident, don't look. You know, it's not your business. If you can ever help and do something, do so. Otherwise, put your head down and get away. You know, leave it up to the professionals. Did you see that, and did it get much prominence in the United Kingdom? Took a while for the tweet to come out of what appeared to be a white and Anglo-Saxon guy walking the other way, doing exactly the same thing, and no one was concerned about him. And I was a bit worried about all that.
Well, it was horrible, yes. And the photographer himself came out and said, yes, she did look distressed and has kind of apologised. She and he, I think, asked media outlets not to use it any longer. But of course, in the present age, it was already out there on Twitter and has been widely used. No, it's deeply unattractive, and it's a worrying side of British life that has, I think, become more prominent since Brexit. On another incident that got less publicity, but much smaller, I think that same day or the next day, there was a programme on the BBC World Service Radio called World Have Your Say, where they went and got Vox Pops. They went and talked to people who were in Westminster Square, sort of commemorating what had happened. And it was all about, you know, plucky Brits carrying on as usual after this terrible event, after this assault on the bastion of their democracy and so on. And they came to one person, and it was a woman, and she said, actually, I'm a Muslim. And I took off my hijab today because I couldn't face the abuse. Mm. I've been spat at. I've been cursed. I've been abused. And in our mosque, the imam recommends women now not to cover their heads when they're out with their children, so that the children don't face this. And I found it absolutely shocking and horrifying. And the person holding the microphone clearly was just completely nonplussed. This wasn't the story that they were supposed to be saying, and just left it without comment and moved on to the next person.
Two very worrying aspects to that. I mean, one is what the woman said. I mean, I can't put myself in the shoes of being a Muslim woman that wears a headscarf, but I imagine my intuitive reaction is it would be an horrific circumstance to be in when there was a terrorist attack, to be walking around and identified as a Muslim because of all the people who might do just that. So the first aspect is that, you know, we need to recognise people are in this position, a very, very vulnerable position. But the second aspect that you mentioned, which is equally and I was sort of half chuckling because I'm embarrassed at the stupidity of it, that there would be a journalist who would get that information from someone in a very heartfelt way, who's obviously not spinning any bull dust, and just let it go into the ether, not see the mirror that was being put up to him or her.
Exactly.
It's terrifying. Simon Long, it's been a pleasure talking to you again, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Thanks for joining us.
Great talking to you again, Amanda.
Thanks, Simon. That was Simon Long from The Economist in London.